Welcome to episode 147 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and today I'm talking to Michael Kurita, whose most recent novel, How It Happened, was published in mid-May. While I think that all the conversations I have with writers are both interesting and illuminating, this exchange really stands out, at least for me. Michael talked about the crime that inspired elements of How It Happened, but he also got into the process of how he does his best to both tell a good story, one that will engage readers, as well as how he satisfies the writer geek that lives inside of him. Here's Michael Kurita to talk about How It Happened. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. I am really excited that we're talking to Michael Kurita today, whose How It Happened was published in mid-May. So we're 6 weeks past his pub date, but it's just as exciting a read for anyone who likes their mysteries twisty. Congratulations, Michael, and welcome to Speaking of Mysteries.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
I read the genesis for how It Happened sort of came about in the book's press release, and I'm always fascinated by the process writers use to transmute an event into fiction. Could you describe the original crime, which you covered as a young journo, and the elements that stayed with you in the story that you wrote in How It Happened?
Right. It was an abduction that occurred when I was 17 years old, and then the case was still unsolved when I was working as a sort of baby reporter a few years later. And the original crime, a girl named Jill Bierman, a 19-year-old freshman at Indiana University, she went out on a Wednesday morning, beautiful morning in May, and disappeared, and her bike was found actually quite close to where I grew up, to my parents' house, in an area where I, you know, hiked and hung out with friends, and I knew it very well. And it was the first time I'd really seen any violent crime occur that close to home. You know, Bloomington was in Mayberry, but it also was, this sort of thing was exceptionally unusual. Would be unusual anywhere. And one of the really vivid memories I have from that childhood side of things is coming back in a car with my parents and my sister. And my sister was almost exactly Jill's age. And we passed a gentleman who was off the side of the road staring into this creek not too far from where we lived. And my father recognized him. He said, "That's Eric Bierman, who is Jill's father." And I remember the look on Mr. Bierman's face and just his complexion. You know, it was the face of someone who probably hadn't slept in, at that point, 3 or 4 days, and was now having to imagine all of the worst things a father could ever imagine. And then by the time I was working on the story as a journalist, they were searching, when I say they, I mean the FBI, state police, and Bloomington police had created a task force, and they were searching a body of water in another area of the county with police divers. And that was the first front page story I ever had. And we later found out that story, the reason they were searching the creek, it was based on a confession, and the confession held up. The woman who gave the confession stuck by that even when the body was not found. And then the FBI went so far as to actually build a dam and drain this creek. They were that convinced, not just in her story, but in also what they had been able to prove along the way, kind of charting her through the night before the alleged crime. And so they drained this creek and still didn't come up with Jill's body. And it was the following spring, her bones, her remains were found in another county completely. And so what informed the book, what informed how it happened, a combination of this very vivid and visceral memory of Jill's father on that initial search in those initial days, and then the confession that led to this search that ended up being fruitless. And it was a story that, I'll let you ask another question. How about that?
I tell you something, when I was reading how it happened, I was struck by the concept of expectations and how the expectations played into the lives of the two main characters, Rob Barrett and Matthias Burke. And so I'm wondering, am I sort of overthinking, or did this, was this sort of a concept that you noodled as you were building your characters?
Oh, absolutely. That's an excellent read on it. I wanted it to be about expectations and characters who consider the way they are perceived by everyone around them, and how they can use that. The other element that I think was very present while writing this was just the idea of truth being something that could be argued over, could be removed, could be denied. That was the dominant political story of the 2 years I spent writing this.
I can understand that, and it was I just, you know, both these characters in the book, they had roots in the same region, and both of them were kind of expected. The perception of Rob, who went on to become an FBI agent, was that he was a bit of a will-o-wisp, and according to his grandfather, a little bit mushy. And then Matthias, you know, had this presentation to the world of being such a hardworking and, nose to the grindstone, you know, pull himself up by the bootstraps. And it turns out that neither was accurate.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the reasons I wanted to set this story in Maine was similar to the college town where I grew up. There's the town and gown element in a college town, and Maine had a mirror of that in some ways to me, where you have such a seasonal turnover. And I wanted Rob Barrett to be the guy who thinks he's an insider. He feels like he really gets this place, but to the people who are there year round, like, we don't care how many summers you came up here and vacationed. You know, you're not one of us. You don't really get this place. And I wanted that to come back and bite him early. And I also wanted to try to show a little bit of the idea of, I feel like we've all read and written so many books about the veteran detective, the savvy guy who's always a step ahead of the villain. And I wanted to write from the perspective of someone who doesn't have any experience, who doesn't have any wins behind him. And at the start of the book, he gets it all wrong. He goes out and tells these families how their children died, and he promises to come up with the bodies, and fails across the board. And to me, that was just a more interesting detective character than, I've written the many versions of the experienced, either a private investigator or a police investigator, and I really wanted to explore what it would be like to come in with that weight of expectation and promising to get it right, and then getting it completely wrong. What does that do to you emotionally, intellectually? You know, what's the fallout from that?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the state of Maine, and the state of Maine as a location seems to be inspirational. You know, Stephen King, of course, but also Paul Dryden, who also takes sort of a both sides now view of the Pine Tree State. And, you know, I guess that's also what I read, both the fact that
Rob is not considered, you know, from, he's considered from away, is the, I think, the term the Mainers use for somebody. And it's not just that. I mean, your family basically has to have been there for, you know, umpteen generations.
Yeah, I joke, it's kind of like the mafia. So my wife is a fifth generation Mainer. I feel like, you know, in mob parlance, I'm sort of spoken for by her. You know, I can get by because I'm traveling with her, but no one's going to confuse me for really knowing the place. And yet, as a writer and just as a person, having spent as much time up here as I have the sense that I have at least a very good working understanding of it. And I'm always interested in that outsider mentality from a character perspective, because what it gives you is the chance for the place, the setting, to actually become an active character. And I know that's very cliche to say, but what I mean by that is the psychological terrain of this community is pushing back on Barrett throughout the book. And I particularly like that because he doesn't initially realize that it is. You know, he feels very confident in his understanding of the place and the people when he returns. And I love stories where the character has a sense of things from the beginning that begins to sort of shift under its feet as the story moves along. I feel like if you can get the reader in that emotional space, then ideally you have them pretty well hooked because they're emotionally invested in the character's experience.
So as you mentioned, Rob was, you know, wrong. In the initial part of the story, he just blew it. And we're experiencing the story from, the reader's experiencing the story from Rob's point of view. And I felt he was as close to a reliable narrator as a reader can hope for. He acknowledges his that he screwed up and he takes his lumps because of it. But I thought he defied that expectation of a reliable narrator at the beginning of the book by believing the confession of Kimberly Crapo. Is it hard to create a character with real-life character flaws like Rob Barrett?
Yes. I mean, it's a challenge, certainly. But it's also, I think, you know, that is the ultimate job we have when we sit down to tell a story. It's to create a character who generates that sense of shared life experience with the reader, so they can imagine that, you know, it's not pure escapism, it's not pure fantasy, but what I'm trying to do is put the reader in a place where they can imagine making these choices, and they can now imagine the price of those choices. And they start to think about what they would have done different, what they want the character to do. When you have a reader who actively, you know, winces or reacts to a choice that's made later in the book, I think, you know, to me, that's a great win because they're so emotionally engaged that they don't want to see the character make the left turn. They want the character to go right. And you know, that's what I'm always hoping to do. And you can only do that by giving them a character who feels human enough to really be knowable. And then it's less of just a plot driven book, and it's more of a human experience.
You were very young when you started your crime fiction writing career with Tonight I Say Goodbye. You were 20, I believe, when the book was published or when it was accepted for publication. And the book was nominated for an Edgar. And what I want to ask you is, how do you think writing crime fiction has changed since you started, if you think it's changed? But how have you changed as a writer of crime fiction over the arc of your career?
That is a wonderful question. The writing of crime fiction, I don't think it has changed. It shouldn't have. There are countless ways the business has changed, and we could talk about the way writers have moved to try to go with the marketplace. But I think the general task of telling a good story and how you go about it should not have changed. I think that the perception of the crime novel, I came in at a point when with writers like, you know, Richard Price and Dennis Lehane, Michael Connelly, George Feliciano, Flora Lipman, there was this group that had begun to elevate the genre to a place where it was considered more of a social novel and probably begin to get a little more respect than it had in the past in some circles. And then TV helped that enormously. You know, the Wire alone is the Wire and the Sopranos, you know, suddenly pushed the perception of the genre into a, I think, a better place. The second half of your question, how have I changed? It's a great one because the trite answer is that I hope to get better with every book, and that is true. But I also, I wouldn't pretend that each book is the best thing I've ever done. When I set out, that's the goal. The rule I had for myself was I did not want to be put into a box that belonged in too tiny of a space in the genre too early. And that's the exact thing that you mentioned. I was so young when I published, and I very early on resisted the idea of doing too many books with Lincoln Perry, my serious character, in a row, because I did not want to be 26, 27 years old and be the Lincoln Perry writer, and that was, you know, essentially what the audience wanted from me. And so I've pushed in different directions, probably more aggressively because of that. I've done ghost stories and chase novels, you know, one I would consider more a family drama with football, almost than a mystery. But all of that has been done with the idea of, I really believe you get better by testing and stretching. And there are books where I feel probably overreached. And it's always disappointing when you're not thrilled with the end product, but I'd much rather fail for overreaching, if that makes sense.
Yes, I think first of all, the way you described the genre, I thought was just really well done, and I will listen to it and use that explanation. I think the writing in the genre of crime fiction has always been good.
I would agree. Yes.
But you make a very good point about the recognition, and I think that to a certain point, you talk about Michael Connelly and Robert Craze and T. Jefferson Parker and Don Winslow, all of whom I've had the very, very good luck to work with. These men are writers. I should throw in some women: Val McDermott, Megan Abbott. They are not, air quotes, genre writers. They are writers. They are writers of fiction that sort of tear open the human soul and lay it bare for the reader to see. And that's a remarkable accomplishment. And I think that's something that you did in How It Happened. But writing is a humbling experience. It always is a humbling experience, just like you described.
Yeah, when I teach, at a workshop or even just talk to young writers, new writers, one thing I always try to stress is you have to find a way to keep going back to the way you felt about writing when no one was reading you, and hold on to that emotionally, while also seeking to get better from a technical and craft standpoint. And I think that getting better from a technical standpoint and a craft standpoint is probably easier for a lot of people than maintaining the same level of enthusiasm for just telling a story and getting into a character's head and heart and finding out the way they see the world and taking them through, you know, pain and triumph. That's where the business of it begins to press down on you a little bit, and it's easy to warn people against, but I think you do have to experience it before you can really appreciate that once you've written 9 or 10 books and you have film options and you have foreign translations and all of these things are going on, then suddenly you're much more aware of the business and the marketplace. And when I say you, I'm obviously speaking only from my own experience. So I have to find a way to have this, I mean, I would almost call it, you know, childlike enthusiasm for the story that I'm going to tell. Because without that, I feel like I'm going to end up repeating myself. And the reader deserves better than that, because there are so many good writers out there right now. I mean, my goodness, if I can't deliver a story that brings you in the first few chapters and then also holds you and makes you feel like it was worth your time, you should set it aside, because there's a lot of great stuff out there. There needs to always remain a love of just the language and the words. You know, that's something that in his book on writing, I remember Stephen King mentions that, I think it's Amy Tan, said that the thing she wishes writers talked about more is as simple as just the words. And I love that. And I think about that often, because if it doesn't still appeal to you and inspire some passion on a sentence-by-sentence level, then it's either time for you to move on and do something else, or, you know, you've got to go back and figure out where you lost that and how to find it again.
Exactly. Well, you mentioned this in passing, but, you know, you've written crime fiction and supernatural suspense and standalones and series, and you said you did it with a very, very acute eye towards the marketplace, and not having what some writers, actually my partner in Speaking of Mysteries, Les Klinger, says when the publisher says, we want what you did before, only different.
Exactly, yes.
But I have more of a technical question, you know, keeping it all, that do you change gears when you change genres and or switch between a book that's part of a series or a singleton, like How It Happened? And I'm assuming How It Happened is a singleton, although yes. Rob Barrett is a pretty compelling character.
I guess I shouldn't speak too quickly, because usually the best way to know what I'm going to do next is if I say emphatically that I would never do it. So if I say there's no way I'm going back to Barrett, you can count on a Barrett novel in 2 years. That's a really great question about the technical standpoint. And it really is, I would say, one of the most critical reasons for my desire to keep changing it up. I know I make myself more of a challenge for the marketing team when I'm not doing, I love that phrase, just the same thing, only different. But to me, a shift in genre or point of view, even setting, series, character, you know, all of those things, it should come in a way that says, oh, I'm challenging myself on a craft level. You know, I haven't done this before. And that challenge should be part of the thing that gets you excited about the story.
Which, of course, you know, so there may or may not be a Rob Barrett novel in 2 years, because you said you'll never do one again. But what are you working on now?
Well, I just finished a draft of a book that should be out next year in May or June, and that's a standalone. And it is, I think, it's a complete change up from How It Happened, and that this one I wanted to be a story that was kind of all about velocity and a condensed time frame. So in many ways is structurally a polar opposite of how it happened. But those are things that probably, I think, either you need to be a little bit of a writer geek to care about that. You know, I think most readers are going to say, give me a good story and well told, and they're happy with that. But I think the writer geek in me is always, when I'm done with the book and I've been immersed in it for a year or two, I want the sort of the, it's almost like recharging. Yeah, I get a different energy if the narrative itself, the way the story is told, is tweaked somehow from what I've been doing for the last 12, 15, 20 months.
Well, it gives us something to look forward to. Thank you again, Michael, for joining us and talking about your process, your stories, Maine. And I look forward to talking to you next year when your next book comes out.
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to someone who actually really knows the genre. That is clear. But I can tell that you're the what I just described as the writer geek.
I'm a writer geek.
There's nothing to make happier.